From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, American Psycho, we talk with Mary Harron about writing and directing her new film adaptation of the controversial Bret Easton Ellis novel. It's about a Prince of Wall Street who wears and buys all the right things, but is really a monster who murders women. Our film critic John Powers described the movie as the best possible adaptation of a novel famous for being despised. Also, The History of Strange Fruit, the ballad about lynching made famous by Billie Holiday. We talk with David Margalek about his new book about the song. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Too Much Coffee Man, the new CD by singer Bob Duro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal appeals court has ruled that Elian Gonzalez must remain in the United States until an asylum hearing next month. The boy's Miami relatives say the decision's a victory for them in their fight to gain custody of the boy and keep him from being returned to his family in Cuba. The court didn't address the question of who should have custody of Elian while the legal issues are being resolved. In response to the court ruling, Attorney General Janet Reno said the Justice Department is still considering its options. She pointed out that the court order doesn't preclude her from turning Elian over to his father's custody. More from NPR's Tom Gelton.
Janet Reno agreed last week not to remove Elian from the home of his Miami relatives until the appeals court ruled on the family's request for an injunction. But she did not repeat that promise in her reaction to the court ruling. She said the Justice Department will abide by the court's order that Elian not leave the United States as long as his case is before the court, but she argued that the ruling did not disagree with her determination that Elian should be reunited with his father, nor preclude her from placing Elian in his father's care. And she hinted that this remains her intent.
The immigration laws clearly call for a child to be placed in the care of a parent in preference to a more distant relative, while the child's immigration status is being resolved.
Reno said the Justice Department will consider its options and take the action we deem appropriate under the circumstances. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Canadian police have arrested a 15-year-old Montreal boy in connection with the attacks that overwhelmed a number of popular internet sites in February. The boy, known by his online name of Mafia Boy, is accused of sending fake requests for service and information to CNN.com. Other sites affected during the period were Yahoo and eBay. Today in St. Louis, House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt publicly declared his opposition to the Clinton administration's plans to establish a permanent normal trade relationship with China. Kevin Lavery reports from member station KWMU in St. Louis.
Gephardt says trade with the U.S. has not been enough to persuade the Chinese government to respect human rights and promote the rule of law. Gephardt adds he would support normal trade relations with China without major changes to its human rights policy if he felt the U.S. would continue to pressure China on the issue.
But I'm not willing to take every mechanism away, give them the good housekeeping seal of approval, and act like everything they're doing is good, because it's not. That's the wrong message to be sending to the leaders in China.
The House will vote on a bill granting normal trade relations with China next month. Most Republicans back the measure, but so far it lacks the necessary Democratic support needed to pass. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Lavery in St. Louis.
The Dow Industrials lost 92 points today to close at 10,675 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton and Attorney General Janet Reno are in Oklahoma City to attend today's ceremony remembering the fifth anniversary of the federal building bombing. The city's dedicating a memorial to the 168 people who died in the blast in April of 1995. A UN report blasted the mining company responsible for the recent cyanide spill into a Romanian river. The report says people in three countries could face chronic health problems linked to the spill. Claire Duell reports from Geneva.
The UN has blamed the Australian mining company for causing the cyanide spill, which polluted rivers in three countries. It says design deficiencies in the mining process and inadequate operating conditions unleashed up to 100 tons of toxic sludge into rivers in Romania, Hungary and Yugoslavia. The company's contingency plans, it says, were rudimentary, but that they did respond reasonably well to the emergency. After the disaster, environmental groups expressed concern that the food chain could be contaminated. Near to the spill, cyanide levels in the drinking water registered 60 times higher than allowable. But the UN believes there's little immediate risk to human health. However, it warns nearby residents could face chronic health problems because the area is polluted with heavy metals. For NPR News, this is Claire Doule in Geneva.
Italian Prime Minister Massimo D'Alema has resigned, putting an end to Italy's 57th government since the end of World War II. D'Alema first offered his resignation on Monday after his coalition suffered serious losses in regional elections. President Carlo Ciampi will have to find a new prime minister from D'Alema's coalition or call a general election. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Mary Harron directed and co-wrote the new movie adaptation of the Bret Easton Ellis novel American Psycho. She also directed the movie I Shot Andy Warhol. American Psycho is about a 26-year-old Prince of Wall Street in the 1980s who dresses in the right suits, applies daily facials, and has beautiful living room furniture and an attractive girlfriend. Although everything in his exterior life is perfectly controlled, he's going mad, murdering women in gruesome ways that were explicitly described in the book. Our film critic John Power said, Bret Easton Ellis' novel was intended to satirize Reagan-era greed, but he wrote it so ineptly that it was merely vile. Its idea has been redeemed by Harron, who specializes in brainy, aestheticized versions of tabloid material. Here's a scene from the movie in which the main character, Patrick Bateman, played by Christian Bale, is showing his new business card to his colleagues, hoping to show them up.
New card. What do you think?
Whoa. Very nice. Look at that.
Picked them up from the printers yesterday.
Good coloring.
That's bone. And the lettering is something called Cillian Braille.
It's very cool, Bateman, but that's nothing. Look at this.
That is really nice.
Eggshell with Romalian type. What do you think?
Nice.
Jesus. That is really super. How'd a nitwit like you get so tasteful?
I can't believe that Bryce prefers Van Patten's card to mine.
But wait. You ain't seen nothing yet. Raised lettering. Pale nimbus. White.
Impressive. Very nice. Mm. Let's see Paul Allen's card.
Look at that subtle off-white coloring. A tasteful thickness of it. Oh my God. It even has a watermark.
American Psycho is about the extreme some people go to in order to be, or at least look, successful. Bateman lives in a world of perfect surfaces, but inside he's a monster, and in that sense, Mary Harron sees her movie as a horror film.
Part of it's sort of his disintegration into further madness. And it's also, I suppose, about how he tried. This man who is deformed, who has nothing there, he's got this terrible void, he's just not a human being, how he constructs his surface identity so that he passes kind of, he hides his monstrousness with by wearing, you know, the perfect clothes and the perfect, being in all the right restaurants. So I guess that's what it is to me.
Now, the novel American Psycho was boycotted by Now in Los mm-hmm. Angeles for its gruesome violence against women. How do you think the movie adaptation compares to the novel?
Well, it's much less violent. I wasn't really interested in portraying the more, graphic aspects of the novel. I didn't think it would work on film. I mean, film is obviously, more powerful medium in that sense, and a little goes a long way. But I think that the book always had very strong elements of social satire that got overlooked totally at the time it was published. I think it's been recognized in the years since as a kind of quite a brilliant, social analysis of the late 80s.
How do you think your portrayal of sex compares to the portrayal in the film?
There's only one big sex scene in the film, and that's the one that got the censorship problems. In the novel, it's, I think, or I've always taken it to be, clearly a sort of pornographic fantasy, because it's about a man with two prostitutes, one a street prostitute, the other a sort of expensive escort girl. And he's paying for sex, but he writes in the first person in the novel about this sexual encounter as if it's an incredibly hot sexual scene. And to me, when I read it, I thought, oh, this is a sort of hilarious, you know, parody, really, because it's written like one of those pornographic fantasies in a men's magazine, but it clearly is not real. Because prostitutes, you know, who are being paid to have sex do not react like that. So when I was directing it, I had a different task. I had to show that it was him trying to recreate a fantasy. So I had Christian Bale, who plays Patrick Bateman, the main character, looking in the mirror the whole time while he's having sex with these girls. And then he's just ordering them around in a kind of curt way. And they look kind of bored and disconnected. And it's a disturbing scene because it's about sex as a transaction. And it's about, in a way, both the banality and the bleakness of that kind of sex.
It's also, I think, about sex as an act of narcissism on his part. It's like, oh, how do I look?
yes, all those things. So it's not at all a sexy scene. We kind of put you off, I think. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, the censors focused on that, and we had to take about 20 seconds out of it.
No, it's funny. You know, the character at the center here is a man who is satirized for the kinds of obsessions that we usually associate with women: having the right clothes, mm-hmm. the right home furnishings, the right facial cosmetics, a great looking body, dinner reservations at the right restaurants. I mean, in your standard satire, it would be a woman who had those problems, not a man.
Well, that's what I liked about the novel so much. Was that Brett had caught the vanity and narcissism of these very macho Wall Street guys. They're all mergers and acquisitions, you know, executives. And, you know, they think of themselves as, you know, incredibly, you know, thrusting alpha males. But they act like teenage girls. You know, they backbite. They, you know, one of them leaves the table and the other one says, oh, he looks puffy. I guess he hasn't been working out. You know, they're incredibly competitive and insecure. And I thought that Brett... I've never seen anyone else capture that aspect of that kind of machismo society. But there is, you know, and there's a kind of a homoerotic undercurrent to it as well. But I felt like that, it seemed pretty devastatingly accurate to me.
Now, the novel, American Psycho, was criticized as anti-woman, and it's paradoxical, I suppose, that it's been adapted by two feminists, you know, you and your screenwriting collaborator, Guinevere Turner, who made the movie Go Fish, which was about a young lesbian woman.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there can be a very literal-minded judgment on content, I think, today in books and films. So that if something is a portrait of misogyny, it is taken to be misogynist itself, mm-hmm. that the book is guilty of what it is portraying. And political groups like Now, who are very effective politically, are sometimes, I think, very conservative and literal-minded in their judgments of art, or in this case were. I mean, the book does have some, you know, terrible scenes of violence I don't much like reading myself. But that doesn't mean that its intention was misogynist.
You mentioned that the sex scene in the movie in which he's having sex with a prostitute and a woman who works for an escort service ran into censorship problems. Was this the rating that you're talking about?
Yes, it was. Originally, they threatened to give it NC-17, and then I trimmed a few seconds out of that scene and was given an R rating.
What did you have to trim out?
Just a little bit of the more explicit sexual stuff. It's not a very explicit scene, but, you know. Pelvic grinding, I guess you'd say.
Uh-huh. And how did you feel about losing that? Did you feel like you sacrificed the integrity of the scene, or was it okay to lose it?
I wasn't happy about it, but I felt better than I would have if I'd had to cut the whole scene. And in Europe and Canada, it's going out uncut, so that's a great compensation.
So your alternative was to cut a little or cut the whole scene. The alternative wasn't to leave it alone and get the NC-17 rating?
Well, if you get an NC-17 rating, it effectively destroys your film. Because you can't, there's many theater chains won't show it, Blockbuster Video won't stock it, you know, any film of any kind of budget at all just can't afford to do that.
Mary Harron is my guest. She co-wrote and directed the new screen adaptation of American Psycho. She also wrote and directed I Shot Andy Warhol. Now, when the main character in American Psycho brings women to his apartment to have sex and then murder them, he plays his favorite CDs by people like Huey Lewis in the News and,
Phil Collins.
Phil Collins, yeah. And he gives these little lectures about them. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you used to be a rock critic before becoming mm-hmm. a filmmaker, and I'm wondering if the things that he says in the movie is inspired either by bad rock criticism or press releases.
Well, I have to say, I would love to take credit for these things. I didn't, you know, that's all in the book. They're one of the things that sort of made me warm to the book was he'll follow some quite, you know, horrifying scene with an entire chapter of music criticism. Completely out of context. It's just there in the middle, in the center of the novel. He'll suddenly write a whole chapter about Huey Lewis. And it's very funny. It's a very funny parody of rock criticism, but it's also revealing about Bateman because in these kind of upbeat mainstream pop songs, it's the only place where Bateman actually shows emotion, where he seems to find a reflection of his own soul, and he finds depth and meaning in Huey Lewis and Phil Collins.
Now, it's very important for the main character in this movie to have the right fashions and the right home furnishings. This is how he defines himself. This is what he lives for. So did you want the clothes and furnishings to really say 1980s, or did you want them to be a little more timeless so that they could say now as well as then?
No, I was very specific about wanting everything to be late 80s. In fact, it was quite an ordeal because the late 80s have not yet become a period that people collect. So actually finding things like late 80s cell phones or, you know, video recorders is not easy.
What about the living room of his apartment?
Well, I told Gideon Ponte, the production designer, that I wanted it to look like a page out of Architectural Digest, you know, in 1987. So it's minimalism, a lot of white, a lot of black, matte, you know, stereo equipment. And then the kitchen is stainless, a lot of stainless steel, because I like the stainless steel because it made it look like a morgue. You know, it's kind of sinister. The apartment looks totally unlived in.
Christian Bale plays the main character, Patrick Bateman. What did you tell Bale about how you wanted him to portray the character?
We talked a lot about it over a long period. It's a difficult part to play because it's not a naturalistic character. It's not psychologically realistic. No one like Patrick Bateman has ever or ever will exist. He's kind of a construct. You know, he's symbolic, really. But at the same time, you have to make him believable on screen. So Christian and I talked about Patrick Bateman as being like a Martian who had come to Earth, who was pretending very hard to be a human being, but inside was nothing of the kind. And Christian says it's difficult because in most performances, you're trying to hide the fact that you're acting. But here, you had to display it, because that was the whole point. His whole life is a performance.
After you had cast Christian Bale as the main character in American Psycho, the movie production company wanted to sign Leonardo DiCaprio in the role. Why did they want to make that change?
Well, I think, you know, he was the biggest star in the world. I guess you can't blame them at the time. But I had already cast Christian. I felt very committed to him. And I also thought that it was a mistake to make it a huge budget movie with a big star, because you can't really afford to make a risky movie on that scale. And American Psycho is a risky movie in many ways. The riskiest thing about it, I think, is not the violence, because it's not particularly violent, you know, in a graphic sense. But the main character is somebody that people would consider extremely unsympathetic. You know, most stories about, you know, a serial killer or a murderer, you know, you make the detective the main character. But in this, you know, you do focus on Patrick Bateman, and it's an unusual move in the films.
I think DiCaprio would have made $20 million had he signed for this. That's what he was being offered.
Yes, and you know, in the end, the whole budget of the movie that Christian and I made was under $10.
Right. Yeah. So when the movie company told you that they wanted DiCaprio in the movie before you knew that he was going to sign for The Beach instead, mm-hmm. What did you do? Did you say, then, I'm out, or, well, you know, we'll see what happens? I mean, how did you handle it?
I just said, I just disagreed very vehemently. And at that point, they wanted me to meet with, and I didn't particularly want to meet with Leonardo, because I felt that would just compromise my position. And, you know, they, I think, didn't particularly want to keep me at that point because with a bigger star, they wanted a bigger director anyway.
Mm-hmm. So are there any movie-making lessons you learned from this experience?
I guess, you know, it is a great lesson because, you know, it was my project and, you know, the script that I had co-written and had shepherded and helped sell, you know. Had gone around to many companies trying to sell it with the producers. I think it's amazing how expendable one is. You know, you should never imagine that you're not expendable. On the other hand, I think I did the right thing. At the time, I couldn't be sure. But I think if you're a director and you care very much about a project and you think that the casting is going in the wrong way and that you will lose control of the project, even if you stay on the film, it probably won't. It'll be a disaster. And I think that the person who suffers the most in those cases is the director. You know, it's not worth it.
Mary Harron will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mary Harron is my guest. She directed the new movie American Psycho, which she also co-wrote, and she wrote and directed the earlier film I Shot Andy Warhol. Your earlier film I Shot Andy Warhol has something in common with American Psycho. Both films are about people who are mentally ill and mm-hmm. and willing to kill, or at least try to kill. Your film, I Shot Andy Warhol, is based on the true story of Valerie Solanas, who shot Andy Warhol and nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. But you know, fortunately, he survived that shooting. What interested you in her story?
I Shot Andy Warhol is the story of someone who is as much driven mad by the society as they are, you know, intrinsically mad, I think. I was interested in her isolation and that she had this sort of mad but visionary quality in her writing. That her critique of sexual politics, which is very extreme, you know, obviously, and in itself also kind of satirical, but was remarkably prescient. And she said things in like 1966, 67, people weren't saying for years until years later. And that this is someone who obviously had a vision of how she felt the world really worked that ran totally counter what everyone in society was telling her, which was that men were superior to women. And in a way that drove her mad. And I think she had, you know, schizophrenia. I mean, I think she had madness in her. But I found her story more poignant. I think it was someone who, in a way, also was born at the wrong time. If she had been born 10 years later, she might have found a much more sympathetic environment. Patrick Bateman is a very different character. He's, you know, he seems on the surface to be absolutely at the center of his world, you know, to be one of its finest specimens. And inside, he's, you know, this sort of monster.
Where were you in the late 1980s when American Psycho was set?
Well, I was working in television documentaries in Britain. And I guess before that, I'd been a struggling freelance journalist. So it was the only time, first time I had ever made any money. So I was probably a yuppie myself, you know. I don't think you can satirize something if you haven't been a part of it. And I was working in Britain, but we would do a lot of filming trips to New York, which would mean, you know, staying in hotels and being on expense accounts. And so I did see some restaurants and some nightclubs, and it got a view of the stuff that we'd later be reconstructing.
Now, I understand that your father, Don Harron, was a Canadian actor and comedian?
Mm-hmm. Or is.
Is, okay,
is.
Yeah.
Still around.
What kind of work did he or does he do? I don't know if most Americans would be aware of it.
Well, actually, he was on Hee Haw for about 18 years, so I think a lot of Americans would be. he played one of the characters on Hee Haw. I mean, he's lived in Canada, but he used to fly down to Nashville. And he played the guy behind the radio desk on Hee Haw. And then he did, you know, my dad did movies, he did classical theater, he did all kinds of things. But for many Americans, that's where they would know him from.
Did his being in the entertainment business lead you into movie making at all?
No, because actually I started out as a journalist. So I guess obviously, I think when I started, directing, you know, film, I realized that I was very comfortable with actors, and I'm sure that, you know, being brought up, you know, being the daughter of an actor helped. But originally I was thought I'd be a writer. I mean, I think partly because when I was growing up, there weren't any women film directors that I knew of, and I don't think it really ever occurred to me that I could be one until much later.
Mm-hmm. No, you're very pregnant right now.
Yes.
You're due very soon?
Yes, in a month.
How has that affected your ability to
think
work? To work.
Well, fortunately, I didn't, I got pregnant after we finished shooting, thank God. I mean, I know women have made, Nancy Zavoca, I think, made 2 movies when she was pregnant, and I don't know how she did it, because it's so physically demanding. I got pregnant while I was editing, and I eventually had to tell my editor that I was pregnant, because I kept falling asleep at the editing room. And, you know, luckily I had the editing, we'd actually hired editing facilities in my building, so I was able to run upstairs and take a nap. It's strange having 2 different, you know, being so involved in both a film and a baby. But that's part of having, you know, I think a family if you're a woman director anywhere, or a woman anything.
And of course, you know, you're carrying this baby at the same time that you're making this movie about somebody who's really quite gruesome.
Yeah.
And the acts that he commits. Did that affect you at all?
Some
people, when they're pregnant, they just want to expose, you know, the baby that they're carrying to, you know, calming sounds and beautiful
music. Yeah, well,
music.
That was not an option for me, because, you know, I had to do all my sound editing, and, you know, I would be sitting there in the final mix, you know, with a chainsaw sequence where we'd have to do it over and over and over again. So sometimes I would just go and sit in the outside lobby, you know, just to, because I would start feeling kicks. So yes, I mean, I sort of regretted that, but on the other hand, I don't feel that as a woman or as a mother that I am just going to make sort of lovely films, or that I won't tackle violence, or that I won't tackle the harsher side of things. I don't think just because you have children, you know, I think having children changes, you know, one's life enormously, but it doesn't mean that it should change your whole artistic sensibility necessarily.
Well, Mary Herron, I thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with your new baby.
Thank you.
And your new movie.
Thanks.
Mary Herron co-wrote and directed the film American Psycho. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of a variety of seeds, plants, home furnishings, tools, and other gardening products. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Inc.'s Dial Press Division, publisher of The Running Mate, a new novel of politics by Joe Klein, author of Primary Colors. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Southern trees bear strange fruit.
Coming up, the history of Strange Fruit, the song about lynching made famous by Billie Holiday. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by Bob Duro.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Singer-songwriter Bob Dorough's fans include Lena Horne and Dennis Hopper. Dorough jammed with beboppers in the 1950s, when he also worked as accompanist to Lenny Bruce and Sugar Ray Robinson. Later, he became the only vocalist ever to record with Miles Davis. In the 70s, Dorough became musical director for and chief voice of Saturday morning TV's Schoolhouse Rock shorts, which aimed at teaching kids reading and multiplication. That 12-year gig gave him more exposure than he ever got with his own records, which were all on little labels, until 3 years ago when he made his first for a major label. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews its sequel.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find a lot of cups to fill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda cause they've got to fill their quota, and the way things are, I guess they never will. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. No tea or tomato juice, you'll see. No potato juice for the planters down in Santos. They say no, no, no. A politician's daughter was accused of drinking water and was fined a great big $50 bill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
The Coffee Song by Bob Hilliard and Dick Miles, as sung by Bob Dorough. According to a leading medical association, some symptoms of caffeine overdose include restlessness, excitability, twitching, and the rambling flow of thought and speech. Bob Dorough's new CD on Blue Note is called Too Much Coffee Man.
He drink it roasted, he drink it toasted, he drink it blended, he drink it instant, he drink it chilled, he drink it scalded, he drink it decaf. No, man. Decaf. Oh, you heard me. No decaf. Too much coffee.
No decaf. Bob Dorough, you're an advertisement for decaf. He says that song is about a friend of his. Uh-huh. These days, Dorough is often tagged as an aging hipster on a mission to cheer folks up, sort of a jazz Mark Russell. But Dorough can win you over even if you didn't learn your times tables from Schoolhouse Rock. The thing is, how does he do it? He has the modest voice of a songwriter pushing his own songs, even when singing someone else's. Whenever he sings a note out of his normal speaking range, he sounds half asphyxiated. His timing and intonation are on the beam, but the impression he gives of barely hanging on is a big part of his appeal. It's almost like he stumbled on stage by mistake and decided to go for it.
I've got just about everything there is to make this hers and his a terrific affair. I've got dewdrops and oceans and all kinds of notions. Since I dig you the most, I've got the urge to share. Yes, I have just about everything. But I know for sure by now, I really want what's lacking. No doubt about it, living without it, I might turn out a slob at best, remain a blob. So baby, now won't you supply? Come on and let's try it. I could go on just as I am year after year. Yet with that one thing more, I know I'll reach the divine. That's to have you and hold you. And now that I told you, please make a positive sign saying that you'll be mine and we'll have everything. Oh, how my heart will sing, and I can say I've got everything I need.
Bob Dorough's bebop credentials are in order, but he was also a behind-the-scenes force in 60s folk and pop music. He arranged for the Chad Mitchell Trio, for the foul-mouthed hippie poets The Fugs on their big-budget masterpiece It Crawled Into My Hand, Honest, and for the harmony group Spanky and Our Gang, who covered this Dorough tune derived from an unlikely text. This is from his version of love, Webster's definition.
One, love, a feeling of strong personal attachment induced by sympathetic understanding or by ties of kinship. Ardent affection. Two, strong liking for, feeling fondness, having goodwill,
as love of learning, as in love of country, as in love of country.
They say some singers have such great pipes they could sing the phone book. Bob Dureau would use it for lyrics. He also plays piano here and holds his own with three snappy rhythm sections that know better than to upstage him. The cast includes drummers Bill Goodwin, Jamie Haddad, and Billy Hart, and alto saxophonist Phil Woods. But it's Dureau's show all the way. He sounds as good as he ever did, which is more than you can say for most jazz singers who record at age 75.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing, which is now out in paperback. He reviewed Too Much Coffee Man by Bob Dureau on the Blue Note label. Coming up, the story behind Strange Fruit, the song made famous by Billie Holiday. This is Fresh Air. My guest David Margalek has written a new book about the history of one song, a song about lynching made famous by this 1939 Billie Holiday recording.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves. Blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain together, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and big.
Strange Fruit was named the best song of the century by Time magazine. In telling the history of the song, David Margalek's book Strange Fruit tells interconnecting stories about jazz, folk music, cafe society, and the civil rights movement. Margalek is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair and former national legal affairs editor for the New York Times. Strange Fruit was composed by Lewis Allen, who also wrote the lyrics, but Lewis Allen was just a pen name.
Lewis Allen's real name was Abel Meeropol. Abel Meeropol was a school teacher in the Bronx in New York City. He was a political activist and but basically sort of a compulsive writer of songs and poems and essays. He was a member of the American Communist Party, and he was a passionate believer in social justice who tried to use his compositions to advance the cause.
I think maybe what he's most famous for is being the adopted father of the two sons of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg.
Yes, this came along later, and this was actually one of the reasons that I wanted to get into the project. I mean, I knew of him independently because I was always interested in the Rosenberg case, and I knew that the Rosenbergs had been adopted by a man named Mirapol. Abel Mirapol and his wife, Ann Mirapol, did not actually know the Rosenbergs. But they were childless, and they were sympathizers with the Rosenbergs. They were sort of in the same leftist community in New York. And when the Rosenbergs were executed and the children were orphaned, the Mirapols, who were childless themselves, made efforts to adopt them. And after considerable difficulties, were allowed to adopt the two children. And I think really saved those two children's lives. I mean, they let the children disappear and have reasonably normal childhoods, which was no mean feat.
Who sang the song before Billie Holiday sang it?
It was kind of a staple of the left-wing bungalow colony set in the Catskills. And Lewis Allen and his wife would perform it together. Various other members of their sort of social entourage would do it. Another black woman sang it at Madison Square Garden at a rally for the Spanish loyalists during the Spanish Civil War. It was kicking around for several years before Billie Holiday got a hold of it. And the interesting thing about it is that it was although there are no earlier recordings of it, it was a very different song. He wrote it in sort of a more jazzy, I guess one can't say upbeat about a song about a lynching, but it was more... It was more sort of assertive less sort of languorous than the version that Billie Holiday eventually did. She slowed it down and put her own stamp on it in the way she did with everything that she sang.
How did Billie Holiday first get to sing Strange Fruit?
Billie Holiday was appearing at Cafe Society, which had just opened in Greenwich Village in New York. It's important to understand that Cafe Society was a unique place in the New York firmament in the late 1930s. It was the only integrated nightclub. Nightclubs, even in New York, even the so-called citadel of progressivism, were still segregated places where whites would go up to Harlem, and even in Harlem, whites and blacks would sit in separate places. Cafe Society was a deliberate attempt to get beyond that, and it was a place where progressive people would hang out. It was a place that set out to be very different, and it had just started, and a fellow who had put together one of the shows in which Strange Fruit appeared mentioned it to Barney Josephson, who was the man who was the impresario behind Cafe Society. And one day, they must have encouraged Abel Mirapol to come in and perform the song for Billie Holiday to see if she'd be interested in it. And so he came in and sat down at the piano and played it for her. And that's how it was brought to her attention.
The story gets complicated here because there's a lot of different versions of who actually played a part in writing the song and how Billie Holiday felt about the song. She takes some of the songwriting credit in her autobiography, which was co-written with William Dufty. She says that Mirapol showed her the song and suggested that her pianist, Sonny White, and she turn it into music. It's a little ambiguous about whether she means make it sound more musical or write a melody.
Yeah, it is a little bit ambiguous. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that Abel Mirapol wrote the lyrics to the song and wrote a tune to set those lyrics to. I think the ambiguity comes in partly because, as I said, Billie Holiday put her stamp on everything, you know, and she clearly changed the song around and changed the whole feeling of the song to suit her temperament and her attitude towards it. I think that therein may lie some of the ambiguity. I think that she may have felt that the version that she ended up singing sounded very little like the one that he wrote. But that's not the way that he felt. I mean, he was there when she first performed it. He said that she made it sound that it was exactly what he had in mind. And he spent the rest of his life really trying to clear up this ambiguity and to insist that the composition was his and his alone.
In her Jazz at the Philharmonic recording of Strange Fruit, she says, "This is a song that was written for me."
Yeah, again, that's, you know, it's part of the sort of revisionist history that that she adopted. It's not so.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Margalek, and his new book traces the history of the recording Strange Fruit. It's called Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday, Cafe Society, and an Early Cry for Civil Rights. Columbia, her record company of the time, didn't record Strange Fruit. She recorded instead on a small label, Commodore Records. Why did she take it to Commodore?
Well, she took it to Commodore because no other major house would have done it. I mean, Columbia had already turned it down, and she must have known of Commodore. She hung out at the Commodore record store, which was actually on 42nd Street near Grand Central Station. Commodore was run by a guy named Milt Gabler, and he was a left-wing type, you know, a progressive type, who recorded a few songs on the side, apart from selling records. And he was somebody who was sympathetic with the message of this song and put it out with very little fear or fanfare, just got it out there. And so she went to him, she recorded four sides that day. They sat down in the studio and sort of wrote out Fine and Mellow on the spot. Fine and Mellow, which is really one of the other very famous songs that she's done. And that was on the flip side. And they recorded these four songs that day.
Yeah, Fine and Mellow, which was, I guess, meant to be the B-side, was really the hit side, wasn't it, of Strange Fruit?
You know, I've never really gotten an answer to that. I don't know. I think that each side had its own constituency. And I don't know, you know, I think people, it was a peculiar thing that was sort of a schizophrenic record. And people bought it for different reasons.
So how much airplay did Strange Fruit get after it was recorded?
It got very little airplay for many years for several different reasons. One reason was that at that point, radio stations weren't playing a lot of records. There was a lot of live music on the air, but not a lot of records. And the other reason was that it was just too sensitive to play. Radio was a very uncontroversial medium at that point. Most of the music was, you know, Lucky Strike, Hit Parade, and shows like that. And the Andrews Sisters. I mean, that was the kind of thing that people were doing. And radio had never really heard anything like this before. So it got very little airplay. There were a couple of disc jockeys who made a point to play it. And I interviewed a very interesting fellow named Daddy-O Daly, who was one of the early disc jockeys in Chicago. And he talks about playing it whenever he could get away with it. You know, you had to submit lists of songs to play, and he would get it on there and try to sneak it by the station brass whenever he could. And he tells the story about how whenever there was a kind of racial episode in Chicago, you know, when a black man ran a red light or something and a cop beat him up, that he would deliberately put the song on the air. The song became a sort of all-purpose protest weapon for him, and he would play it just to remind people of the kinds of things that went on in America at that point.
Now, I think of Billie Holiday as being the singer that owns Strange Fruit, but it's a song that was also very much associated with Josh White's career. How did he start singing the song? And he's much more of a folk singer.
Yeah, I think he must have heard Billie Holiday sing it, because he didn't start singing it until a few years after she did. And he was appearing at Cafe Society, too. I think he started appearing there in 1944. And I think the song must have grabbed him, and he started to do it. And Billie Holiday was very proprietary about it. And the story is told that Holiday came into his dressing room one night, and there are different versions of this story, again, alluded to in the book, about whether or not she was carrying a knife with her. But threatened him and menaced him and said, "Stop doing that song." And he pleaded with her and said, "Billy, we should both be doing this song until no one has to sing it again." And from that moment on, I guess they reached some kind of agreement, and he continued to perform it. And as I say, I think, you know, in terms of the number of people who heard the song in performance, probably more people heard him than her, because his career lasted a lot longer. He performed before a lot more people. And so he did, in a sense, he did as much to popularize the song as she, although to my mind, her version is vastly superior.
Why don't we hear Josh White's reading of Strange Fruit?
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black body swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Oh.
That's Josh White's recording of Strange Fruit. We'll talk more with David Margalek about his new book, Strange Fruit, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Margalek, author of Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday, Cafe Society, and An Early Cry for Civil Rights. How did Strange Fruit change the life of its composer, Abel Meeropol?
Well, I think that I'm not sure if it changed his life at all. It was the composition that he was the proudest of. It was really his most famous composition. The other song that he wrote that people will remember was The House I Live In, which is which Frank Sinatra sang in 1945 in an Academy Award-winning short subject, sort of a plea for tolerance. And it's a lovely song, and still you still hear it every once in a while. Frank Sinatra did it at the bicentennial celebration, for instance.
We should mention Meeropol wrote the lyric for that, and Earl Robinson.
Wrote the lyric, and Earl Robinson, who wrote many other famous songs, did the music for it.
Do you have any idea of whether Billie Holiday loved the song or whether she sang it because she felt it was expected of her? I mean, it is so out of character for her to sing, you know, a protest song, and a song where the lyric has such dramatic import, as opposed to, you know, a wonderful love song about falling in love or out of love, which is what, you know, pop songs typically are. And I say that really believing there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's a fine thing. It's a fine thing for music to be about.
You know, the more research that I did for the book, the more ambiguous the answer to your question becomes. I think she had very mixed feelings about the song. I think that, again, she adopted it, and it spoke to her, and she liked to perform it under the right circumstances. I think that she resented being asked to do it all the time. She didn't, you know, there were often times when she didn't want to do it. There's even evidence that she felt sort of a little bit imprisoned by the song. When I interviewed Bill Dufty for the book, he even mentioned that he felt that one of the reasons that she gave Abel Meeropol short shrift was that she sort of resented that this song had become part of her life and sort of become a metaphor for her life. I think she had very, very mixed, very torn feelings about the song, but she performed it right up until the end.
I wonder how she felt, too, that at least at the beginning of the song's life, it was probably primarily white audiences that really wanted her to sing it.
Yeah, I think that was undoubtedly part of the mix, part of her mixed feelings about it. But I think it was a song principally for white radicals at the beginning. And as I said, one of the interesting things in the evolution of the song is I think that the black community came to it much later and adopted it much later, and it became sort of an anthem there later than it did in the white radical community.
What are some of the interesting developments in the life of Strange Fruit now?
Well, there are various things. I mean, for one thing, it's been adopted by the gay community. There's a story in the book about Strange Fruit having been included in a show in San Francisco, with its lyrics having been changed and the controversy over that.
How were the lyrics changed?
Well, the lyrics were changed to talk about strange fruit as strange gays, to deliberately play on the word fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It's applied to strange fruits in the gay community, the idea that more flamboyant gays are discriminated against by straighter, more subdued ones. And this was included in this review in San Francisco, where it turned out that the gay community was divided about the song. Some of them felt that it was perfectly appropriate to adapt it to their particular situation, whereas others felt that this was Billie Holiday's and this was the black community's song and it shouldn't be mucked around with. I mean, that's one interesting sort of contemporary use of the song.
Well, David Margalef, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Margalef is the author of the new book, Strange Fruit. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Billie Holiday's 1945 Jazz at the Philharmonic recording of Strange Fruit.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And now I'd like to sing a tune. It was written especially for me. It's titled Strange Fruit. I do hope you like it. Bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From Island Records Def Jam Music Group, featuring I Am Shelby Lynn. From new recording artist, Shelby Lynn. Available in stores or on the web, www.islanddefjam.com. And from Random House's Bentham Books Division, publisher of Strong Women Stay Young by Dr. Miriam Nelson, which describes her strength training program for women. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sarah Vowell, contributing editor for the public radio program This American Life and columnist for Salon.com. She has a new collection called Take the Cannoli. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.